Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Shannon M. Turner, and today we have a fantastic show. I'm so excited to be bringing to you Scott Turner Schofield, hometown artist gone not local anymore. He is blowing up the scene on The Bold and the Beautiful, and his co-star on The Bold and the Beautiful, Carla Moseley. Welcome, guys.
I should say I'm Carla's co-star.
Oh, please. Not at all.
I like to start the show with an icebreaker. And I find a lot of times with these shows, there's usually some terms that we need to debunk or debrief on. And with this show, we certainly do have some terms that we probably want to talk a little bit about. So I was thinking, Scott, if you would help us talk about some terms that we're going to be throwing around a lot today.
Okay, so we're going to throw around the term transgender, mm-hmm. and also various forms of that word, like trans or trans woman, trans man. And what we're talking about is people who are born in one body and who find themselves with the overwhelming and completely necessary requirement of becoming the other, what society sees as the other gender. Now, I want to go ahead and say that we're talking about diversity, right? All the people in this room have very different genders. Everybody listening has a different gender than the person next to them. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about when we're talking about people who transition, transgender people who transition, we're talking about people who are trying to find their gender authenticity, trying to live completely authentically as who they are. And actually, that's something that most people in the world want to do, right? Transgender people just go about it in various ways, sometimes through hormones and surgery. And so that's kind of what we're talking about today.
And I think a lot of people still use the word transvestite because of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Make sure
Sweet
we understand. Yes. Let's make sure we understand how that is not a part of this overall ethos.
So, okay. Transvestite is kind of an antiquated word that we're also not really using anymore. People who have that identity refer to themselves as cross-dressers. These are people who generally we're talking about people who are heterosexual men who dress as women, and that, you know, not all the time. It's like a thing that you do sometimes because it fulfills some part of your gender identity, right? But then you can go back to being the, you know, father of three driving Volvo, right? Like, which is a common experience, right? So again, it's part of gender diversity, right? It's kind of under, if we were going to think of transgender as like an umbrella term, we would put that under there, but it's a different lived experience than people like myself, you know, being born a girl and then through a long process of realizing, oh, I'm a guy, like this is what I am, and then going through and sort of coming out and transitioning my world to accepting me, right? Mm-hmm. Or like Carla's character on The Bold and the Beautiful, you know, trying to, you know, having to live authentically and fight for the right to be the person that you have always known you are, whatever anybody else may think, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of part of that identity too.
Thank you. So let's segue over to talking to you, Scott, about who you are as a person before The Bold and the Beautiful ever came into your life as a reality. Where did you grow up? Where were you born, and where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the place. That question doesn't mean anything about my life. or maybe it does, because I was always transitioning from one place to another as a kid. You know, growing up, who I was a little performer. I would, like, you know, terrify my parents all the time in the best ways by, like, saying, like, no, don't watch television, watch me instead. And, you know, all I ever really wanted to do was act. It was a huge part of who I was sort of getting up in front of people and being seen, which for a transgender person is a really kind of deep thing, right? Because I also spent my childhood as a little girl, and I knew, I was very clear that I was a boy, but no one had the framework for that, You know, my parents are wonderful people, and they were like, you're a girl, you know, let's go to the hair salon, let's get your nails done, you know, like just sort of really trying to help me be comfortable in the body that I had, which doesn't have to be the same as the identity that you have, right? So I think I was sort of like always trying to be seen for what I really was, and acting was the way to be something else, right?
And do you remember the first or one of the first times that you had that feeling of, I'm not having the same experience as everyone else around me?
Yes. I had a dance recital, and there's a great photo I'll give you to post up with the archive for this. I was learning tap dance, and we were learning Mickey Mouse's birthday party, and there was one other boy in the class.
That was classic.
Right? And there was this one other boy in the class, so I was like, oh, okay, symmetry. Like, I already had that idea in my head, so I was like, I'll be the other Mickey. That's how this is going to go. And so we had all these rehearsals, and then we get to the recital, and my mom pulls out, like, patent leather Mary Janes and a little skirt. Mm. And this photograph, I'm like staring into the camera, and I'm just, my eyes, I mean, it's just like death glare at the camera. And my mom thought that I was having performance anxiety, but it was because I was misgendered. I was so sure that I was Mickey, and here I was having to go on stage in front of people as Minnie, and it was mortifying as this, you know, little four-year-old, right?
Right. And if she'd been paying attention at that point, she would have known there was no way you were having performance anxiety. Right. There must have been something else going on.
Yeah. So yeah. But, you know, I continued with the performance stuff, and I did theater and, you know, did that as a kid and did that in high school, and ended up going to Emory here in Atlanta, and studied theater there. And what began happening there was my gender expression was very fluid. Like, you couldn't, like, I would get sir'd or ma'amed, like, sort of depending on the light, you know. And while I was doing super well in my acting classes, I couldn't get cast in the shows. My auditions were just turning into nothing, and it was very upsetting, you know, for 4 years to sort of be like, you'd think I could get a role, right? And finally, one of my mentors sat me down and said, look, sometimes you can't wait for a role to be written for you. You just have to do it yourself. And at that point, I was having this experience of, I had learned the word transgender, I had understood that it applied to me, and I was kind of living into that reality and writing about it. And so I made my first one-man show, Underground Transit, which then ended up touring the world for 9 years, all because Vinnie Murphy at Emory was like, hey man, forget these guys, like, let's give you your own production and see what you can do, you know?
And then you went on to create another show, Becoming a Man, in 127.
Yeah.
Easy steps. Were they really easy?
No, that's the whole point. Becoming a Man in 127 Easy Steps, Seven Stages commissioned it. It was the first transgender show that was ever commissioned by the National Performance Network, which is like NEA money and all that good stuff. And it's a choose your own adventure, because I find that that's so much of what being trans is all about, like choose your own adventure, right? So the audience picks a different story, and you get maybe 6 or 8 stories, and so every performance is different each night. And, you know, that's the same way as if you're talking to somebody, you know, every story that you're going to get is different.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing it. Do you still have, there was a wheel that you turned.
Yes.
And so that would help steer the direction of the stories.
Right.
Is that still a part of the show?
Yes, it's actually a decoder ring. Oh. And it had these identities next to numbers. And so you'd say like, oh, I think you're a trans man who's stealth. And that'd be like the numbers 1, 2, 7, right? Mm. And that would give us our story.
Wow. And you have another show now, Debutante Balls.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Debutante Balls is about my life as a debutante. I did high school in Charlotte, North Carolina, and ended up attending 3 debutante balls in a dress. But each time, so they call going to debutante balls, like making your debut, they call it coming out. Like, they unironically, in this, like,
wow.
Totally, yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, amazing.
My God. It's so amazing. And so this is a comedy, obviously. At the same time as these, I was attending these balls, I was also coming out as very different things. First I was a lesbian, and then I was like a radical feminist, and then I was a transgender man, all the while wearing the same leopard print dress. It was a Jessica McClintock. I thought that made it fancy.
Okay. It did.
Love it.
That's fantastic. So now you've done a TED Talk, and that's become something that you're touring with as well. I watched it. It's amazing, really wonderful education. Everybody listening should watch it, or book Scott, or I was about to call you Turner.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. Well, let's do that. Let's tell people why I want to call you Turner and you want people to call you Scott.
Yeah. Okay. So when I first came out, I changed my name. And I changed my name to Scott Turner Schofield. And my family, my mother in particular, didn't like Scott. She's just like, the Scott's not who you are. But Turner is a family name, and it was my mother's grandfather. And so she's like, can I just call you Turner? And so my whole family, you know, you're not in control, like your family, you know. So my whole family started calling me Turner. And so then I called myself Turner because that's what everybody was calling me. And so everybody around me, like you, we've known each other for over a decade now, like almost 15 years, almost, right?
Not quite, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like people just, you know, because I called myself that. But my name professionally was still Scott Turner Schofield. Mm-hmm. And so as I've come to know the world as more of a professional person, people call me Scott, you know, but I chose them all, so I'm mm-hmm. good.
Yeah.
You can call me whatever. Okay. Answers to all.
back to your TED Talk. One of the parts that I really love, you say 1997, where all I knew was I was gay because Ellen DeGeneres was also, and that made sense to me. I did not know what I would become or what I could become. And these words, they matter. You go on to really talk about words and help people understand, as you did at the top of the hour, things like cisgender. You have a great definition of cisgender.
Okay, so cisgender, so you're a cisgender person, mm-hmm. right? You're born a girl and you're a woman now, and all of those things line up for you. Cis means same, right? So your sex and your gender are the same. Trans means there's like a journey there, right? So like I'm transgender because there's a journey that I had to take. So, you know, cis people make up the majority of the world, right? But that doesn't mean that they're normal. That means that they're common.
Yeah, right? Just commonplace.
Right? Like, and it's not even an insult. It's just to say, like, again, going back to gender diversity, right? Like we're actually all part of this big diverse world. Some things are more common than others, but it doesn't make that normal, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't make that the thing that we should aspire to. It just makes it part of a bigger part of diversity.
Yeah. Right? You have another term, trans asterisk. Tell us about that.
Well, so we were using this for a little while in the community. It was the word trans with a little asterisk. And I loved this so much because it meant that, you know, like when you're reading and you see a word with an asterisk, so you go down to look for the footnote to see, like, what is this? What's happening here? You know, what does this mean? And I thought it was just such a wonderful way for people to define themselves. And when I gave the TED Talk, that word, that trans with the asterisk was in use. But talk about the evolution of becoming, right? We don't use it anymore.
Hmm.
There was this whole fight about it and how, like, it was too, it kind of covered over people's journeys by making, you know, one size fits all doesn't work when you're talking about identity. So we scrapped it, but I did like it for those couple years we were using it.
Hmm. Constantly evolving.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And you know, so I want to say to the listeners, look, I understand like all of these words are, you know, you can't keep up. I can't keep up and it's my job, you know? So don't worry about it. You know, just listen, just stay open and allow the things to become rather than trying to sort of grasp and make them to stay what you think they are, what they should be.
Mm. I don't want you to give away all your material, so I'm just going to say we're going to take a break for station ID now. And audience, please feel free to go watch the TED Talk and or consider booking Scott. You can find him on Facebook and on Twitter, and he has a great website. It's scott-t-schofield.com. This is the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Shannon M. Turner on WREK.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out while listening to Atmospherics every Monday through Thursday from midnight to 1:30 a.m. on WRAK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
And we're back. Today we're talking with two stars of The Bold and the Beautiful. Well, star and co-star, as I got checked at the top of the
hour. No, double star. Equal billing here on this imaginary marquee.
Carla Mosley, tell us, who are you as a human being before you got to be on The Bold and the Beautiful?
Wow, that's a huge question.
Let's start with, where were you born and where did you grow up?
Right. Yeah, that's good. So I'm from New York. Just outside the city in Westchester County. And I also grew up a theater kid. And, I love everything that Scott was saying, just about how we can all relate to each other and each other's experiences. Because for me, I grew up in kind of a tumultuous home. It was a very loving home, but we had some crazy things happen along the way, and for me, finding theater was where I was able to be fully myself for the first time. And thankfully, my mom was extremely supportive. Both my parents were extremely supportive, but my mom was my primary caretaker, and she let me really disappear into the theater. And we had a great theater program at my school, and she worked really hard so that I could also take classes and perform at our local art center and go into the city and see shows and do programs down there. So that was where most of my energy went growing up. And then also social justice. We just had the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March in D.C. And, wow. I remember going to that with my mom and my sister and my dad, and we were just constantly volunteering, and the idea of being constantly of service as much as possible is something that was instilled in me at a very young age. Hmm.
You said that you found yourself in the theater, and I'm curious, for all of us theater kids out there, I wonder if it's as much about the community of theater practitioners that you find yourself amongst, or if it's actually being on stage, or both.
It was definitely both for me. I think there's an openness in people who are involved in the arts, and I think we're all seekers in one way or another, seeking to do the really challenging work of investigating the underbelly of ourselves, which is not something that everyone wants to do. It's not easy. And I think it's why we also see so much addiction in our community, because unearthing this stuff is not for the faint of heart. But I think that's something that we all share, and being willing to kind of exist in the cracks and shadows of who we are and investigate the messy stuff, and also the wonderfully light and over the top, joyful stuff that we seek to hold all of that. And so certainly the people and the openness in that community, but then also, just the being on stage, being seen, because I think I hid a lot. I still consider myself to be sort of 50-50 extrovert introvert. I love being around people. I love community. I love collaboration. But I also really love being alone. And I think before I found theater, I hid a lot. And this was an opportunity to really be seen and to use these masks of different characters to explore different sides of myself and also just different sides of humanity and to touch other people.
When was the first time, no, let's not do the first time for you. Let's say, when was the time when you knew not just that this was good for you, but it was going to really, you were going to pop?
I think the first time that I belted you know, like I'm a singer. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of belting, singing in a loud chest voice. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, I was a really quiet kid, and I did a lot to sort of disappear myself as much as possible. And the first time I had a teacher, and I think I was about 9 or 10, who I was singing the song Shy from Once Upon a Mattress, which is, you know, with a character who's the exact opposite of shy, but she's talking about how shy she is. So this really, really loud, belty song. And this teacher got me to sing in my full voice. And I'll never forget that moment, like feeling the power of my own voice and realizing that that was in me and that it has been in me and like waiting to explode out of me. I think that was the moment for me that I was like, oh, I have something to say. People want to hear it and they're going to hear it.
That sounds fantastic. Mm. So you mentioned how theater leads you to explore the dark places. You told me that you are an ambassador for the National Eating Disorders Campaign, and I said, mm-hmm. you know, that always leads one to wonder if you have a connection to that story yourself. And you said, yes, I'm talking about that more these days. Would you tell us more about that?
Sure. You know, again, going back to addiction mm-hmm. runs in my family, it runs deep. As unfortunately, I think it does in many of our families in mm-hmm. different ways.
Yeah.
And for me, thankfully, you know, drugs and alcohol never really interested me, but food was something that was like the first hook. It was before I found this voice and this outlet, I would just shove everything down. And that's the way that I learned to cope with things. And, you know, I didn't want to, in my mind, what I thought was burdening other people with like how big I was. The huge emotions that I felt, or this like huge personality that was only that I could feel lurking inside of me, bubbling inside of me, wanting to burst out. And so I would shove it down. And then as I got older, you know, it started to show on my body, and being in this world, this, you know, first of all, just in the world in general that tells us that all has all of this messaging about our bodies and what we should look like, and then also being a Black woman, or then a Black girl growing up in a predominantly white community, so I had a body type that was very different and that was not celebrated in the way that some of my thinner peers were celebrated. And then just, you know, yeah, going into the theater and eventually film and TV that has all kinds of messaging about like what is going to be hireable and what is the ideal. And so I became fixated on my body. And yet at the same time, I was still trying to shove down feelings with food. And so I started over-exercising. I started fasting. I never dieted because, you know, I was a feminist, so I don't diet. But I would fast. You know, it's like all of these like crazy things. And then eventually I started vomiting. And that, when I got to that place, that's when I realized, you know, I'm out of control. And it was a process of years to then walk it back and to get in touch with all of the feelings that that are underneath. And today, you know, thankfully, it's not all, you know, food in my body is not the number one thought in my mind. And it was for a long time. I was, like, abnormally fixated on it. And that's not the way that it is today. And I'm so grateful that I get to show up at work and focus on my work instead of focusing on what I think other people are thinking I look like. And you know, it just allows me to do the work that I really want to do. And when I have moments of like, oh gosh, I'm bigger than everyone or I look different from everyone, one, I know that I can't see myself. Mm. So I really don't know. And the other piece is that like I get to represent a healthy woman's body because I know that's what I'm in today. And so I just let that buoy me when I feel afraid.
So what does the National Eating Disorders Campaign do, and what is your role with it?
Sure. It's NEDA, NEDA, the National Eating Disorders Association. And they are a network of a nonprofit organization, and they have support phone lines, and they help direct people to getting treatment, and they also support the families of people going through eating disorders. It was actually started by a mom whose daughter suffered from an eating disorder, and she just didn't know where to go. And so it's a really great network, powerful network of people who are working to get funding and also have have eating disorders recognized as a mental illness, because it is the number one killer, actually, in mental illness, in mental illnesses. But it doesn't get funding, and it doesn't get funding like alcohol and drug addiction recovery. You know, people are often not able to stay in rehabs as long as they need to, and you know, so that's the kind of work that they do, collecting data and research, and also supporting people on a day to day basis.
Thank you for doing that work. You have a hometown connection here to Atlanta. You have a singer-songwriter partner who is here in Atlanta.
My songwriting partner Corey Shoemake is he's a local, and he is actually coming out to LA. We've been Skyping. He moved back down to Atlanta around the time that I moved from New York out to LA. Although I still go back and forth, because he was missing he was missing his hometown. So he's like, I'm done with this, you know, Northeast. Yes, I'm going back home. And we'd already formed this songwriting duo called the Soul Folks. And we do sort of acoustic folk mixed with gospel, jazz, classic R&B feel, a little bit of rapping. It's good stuff. So we've been Skyping every week and writing a song a week for the last 6 months, and he's coming out to LA to perform in November, and we've been talking about me coming out there, so you know, you might see the Soul Folks popping up pretty soon.
I can't wait.
Because
of your work on The Bold and the Beautiful, you were given the resources, the time, the talent, the space to work on a web series called Room 8. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, our producer Brad Bell is, I don't know if he's like psychic or he just has a personal line to the heavens. Like, it's kind of amazing the way that he's one of these people who can really see the fullness of someone's talent and utilizes all of it in smart ways. So when I first came onto the show, it was actually because of a web series that I co-created with my another creative partner, Lawrence St. Victor, who plays Carter on The Bold and the Beautiful. And Brad hired both of us together, and a couple months down the line asked us to write a web series similar to the one that we had created, you know, a couple years back. And so we got to write this really fun, quirky web series called Room 8 about these two, you know, it's basically the odd couple with a little sexual tension. And then we got the support of CBS and an entire crew and, you know, wardrobe and makeup. So, I mean, going from guerrilla style shooting this web series over 2 days in our various apartments to having a full studio at our disposal was quite a treat.
So web series are becoming quite a thing. I mean, Drunk History and Broad City got their starts as web series. Tell us, what do you think about how they fit into the ecology of arts and entertainment these days?
Well, you know, I think one thing that was instilled in me in college, I went to NYU. I studied musical theater first at Cap 21, and then I moved to the experimental theater wing. And it was such a perfect balance for me because in TAP, I learned, you know, really solid technique and, you know, Meisner-based acting training and dance and all of that, the wonderful fundamentals. And then I went to ETW, and it was like, but also, sort of going back to the singing moment, it's like, you have a voice, and we want to hear your particular brand. So it's like, you don't have to fit into these boxes that people have set out for you. You can create your own work, and you don't have to wait for someone to give you an opportunity. You create yourself. And so that was something that was instilled in me, and I think many of my peers, or, you know, many of the people that I went to school with. And I think this is kind of an extension of that. I think all of the great creative revolutions have been led by people who find a way to make the art that they feel is inside of them. And the internet has now given us a way to do that that is so easy, you know, between iPhones and all of the things that we can do literally from the palm of our hand. It's accessible, and sometimes it can be overwhelming, the amount of material and media that there is out there, but it's also incredibly exciting that, you know, we can have an idea and very pretty easily and inexpensively see it come to fruition.
Wonderful. You can find out more about Carla Mosley on social media, as well as her website, carlamosley.com. Thank you for being here. We're going to take a quick break.
Hey, this is Zach Miller, and you're listening to WREK Atlanta.
And we're back. This is the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Shannon M. Turner, and today we're talking with Scott Turner Schofield and Carla Mosley, who are currently on The Bold and the Beautiful with a very interesting plot line. Bold and the Beautiful started in 1987. It was is a spinoff of The Young and the Restless. There are several characters from the Bell family that have crossover between the two shows. And Carla, you've been on the show for 3 years now. Your character disclosed that you are trans just as she was getting engaged, which was a big reveal, correct?
Yeah.
Did you know... That this story arc was coming, and how far in advance? Like, were you cast with this as the intention?
No, I wasn't. I was cast 3 years ago, and she, you know, we've known Maya for 2 years without knowing this truth about her. I found out when we came back from our holiday break last year, so around mid to the end of January, Brad called me into his office and hey, so, you know, we've had these rumors about a secret that Maya has, and here's what it is. And are you cool with that? And I was, you know, really excited that we were going to tell the story. And also in talking to Brad, the commitment that he had to telling the story authentically and taking his time with it, and also including trans actors, because I, as an African-American woman, I understand how important it is that we be able to tell our own stories. And, you know, my main trepidation going into it is, like, why me telling the story? And I'm grateful that I have been able to, but I also understand the responsibility of it. So I knew for about a month before anyone else in the cast knew. And then, even then, we really, like, soap secrets are notoriously leaked these days. It's like there's never really a secret that is kept. But this one was. And it was a huge reveal right in March, just before March Madness. So the audience found out on Wednesday. And then, and the audience found out before Maya's partner found out on the show, like, probably a month and a half before her sister comes to town and confronts her. And so they found out on Wednesday, and then we didn't have another show airing until Monday. And so it was like 4 days of people going, is this real? What's happening? What does this mean? And that's where social media was a beautiful thing, because I could get on social media and I said, hey guys, I have these 2 hours blocked off on this day. You can ask me any questions that you want. And if I don't know the answer, I have, you know, because I'm a Rachel researcher, I have links to many other people who can tell you their experience and, you know, whose books you can read. And so through that, it was like we got to kind of, as a entertainment community, or, you know, whatever, social media community, process the news. And I it's been wonderful to watch audience members kind of take this journey and the evolution and education of their consciousness.
Was there controversy about the fact that you're a cisgender woman playing this role?
There hasn't been too much, at least that's come back to me. People certainly have questioned it, and I think because it was something that I was so aware of from the beginning, I also have just been open with it as much as possible, and acknowledging my own privilege being a cisgender woman in the position to play this role, you know. I think that in some ways, I think the benefit to having it come out this way is that people have known Maya for 2 years, and so when you've known someone, when you've known a character, similarly, if you've known a person, and then you find out a piece of information about them and have a feeling whether it's like, this is totally okay with me, or I suddenly don't like this character, you know, it forces you to question, okay, well, why? You know, prejudice that you might not have known had the character been introduced as trans. So I think that has been a benefit, but I also have just recognized the problem. You know, there are so few. I just learned that Maya is the only series regular trans character on broadcast TV right now, the only one. And so if you have one character representing the community and that's played by a cisgender person, it's a problem.
Well, but I also think, you know, and I, before I got this role, was one of those people who was really out there sort of saying, you know, we need transgender actors in transgender roles, you know, very critically and kind of harshly in a way. And I think the fact that, you know, A, you'd been on the show for 2 years already. It wasn't like they hired a cisgender actor to play a transgender role, right? Like, it was already, and they were taking one of their main, you know, leading ladies, right? And so that in itself was sort of a turnaround on, you know, because, you know, we've got Elle Fanning playing a trans boy right now in a movie with Susan Sarandon. We've got the Danish girl, right? You know, all of which, like, these actors, I mean, I can't fault them as actors, right? But at this point, it's like, look, you're just not even trying. You know, like, producers, directors, casting directors, you're not even looking, you know, when you don't even look to find someone. But that The Bold and the Beautiful, that Brad's first thought was, and we're going to hire a transgender actor to round this out. You know, I think it just really took The Bold and the Beautiful out of the conversation about the problems that we're having, you know. And then, you know, we went from there to having a whole transgender fashion show, and the fashion show in The Bold and the Beautiful is such a huge, huge thing. And they, you know, they brought Carmen Carrera and Isis King, these, you know, top models who are also trans, like, brought them in. And, you know, it's just The Bold and the Beautiful, the whole thing around this storyline has been so well done, and it's really been a model. And it's interesting because the people who are having the conversations in the press right now aren't talking about The Bold and the Beautiful and what we've done, maybe because it doesn't fit in with the critique that still needs to be had, and that's fine. But I'm just so proud to be a part of something, you know, like this, that we did it so right and so well, you know.
So, Scott, let's talk about your role. You play a character from Maya's past who sort of is her mentor. And I have to read this. This was so amazing. When you announced being cast on your website, or maybe it was your Facebook, you said, amazing how you can go from unknown to famous in a day. I am grateful to be to be able to help uplift and honor transgender people in this moment. I had such help from my communities becoming me. And, you know, as someone who's local to Atlanta, I have to say I watched this moment in Seven Stages where you just got swamped by people as folks realized that you were there. And I asked you after, what was that like, you know, to be in, you know, back in this place that was in some ways your
so
artistic home.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you just couldn't walk through, you know, without having people literally clawing onto you. I had to walk away from it, actually. I couldn't.
You were like, I can't handle it.
Yeah, because that was the moment where I was about to ask you to be on the show. And
we couldn't. I couldn't talk to you. It was like too many people were. It was funny. Well, I mean, what's amazing about it is just that like everybody's so excited, you know, that, you know, we've all been watching each other. It's like, you know, Topher Payne now off Broadway and just getting all this, you know, recognition for his work too. You know, like what I love about Atlanta is that we love a hometown hero, right? We love it. I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me or said to me on Facebook or whatever, like, you deserve this. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I don't know what you mean by that. But, right? But, like, who doesn't, right? But that, like, we've been watching you work so hard and we're so happy for you that it was all completely good. It was all good juju. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it just felt so good to be standing there in front of all these people that I've worked with, that I've had made community with, you know, and for us all to be happy that something good has happened, mm-hmm. you know, and that I would be just as happy for them, whatever was happening for them, you know. So it's overwhelming a little bit, mm-hmm. but it's so nice, you know.
So on the show, as we said, you're mentoring Maya.
So the mentor thing is like a funny thing. What we imagined, the writers and all of us together kind of imagined, was that Nick, my character, was there leading a support group when Maya first came to Los Angeles and transitioned. And that's how Nick and Maya got to know each other. None of this is in the actual, this is just kind of what we imagined, right? Mm-hmm. Because we were thinking, like, how would a white trans man and a black trans woman, like, be in the same world together? How would they be such friends, mm-hmm. right? And
does that not happen?
You know, it does, but and here's how. It happens in those situations where you're in a support group or an activist community and you grok with one another, that sort of the issues of your life, the issues that you're focusing on, are what's important and not the labels that would otherwise divide you, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always saw, like, sort of, you know, Nick really kind of able to hear Maya, like, somehow maybe they come from similar backgrounds or something like that, and like that he's just able to, like, sort of hear her and be there for her in the way she needed and give her the perspective or whatever it was that, or not even that, I think more just hold the space for her, you know. And it's those people who held the space for you in those moments when you were just beginning to really blossom and become yourself, that always, whether you see them for 10 years or not, right? Like they stay important to you, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have people like that, you know, who have been there in really challenging points in our lives, and that can never be erased, even if you go 50 years without seeing each other.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, when it was in the press that, like, Nick was Maya's mentor, I was always a bit like, no, Maya, it's clear that Maya knows exactly who she is and has been, you know what I mean? Like, she didn't need that, but maybe, like, further back, he just held some space for her, and that's what, mm-hmm. you know, that's what brings them so close together.
Mm-hmm. So, Carla.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. So, is there, sorry,
taking
over the interview. So, is there a strong racial divide? I mean, I guess in all communities, but in the trans community?
Yes, because particularly, you know, so we have, what month is it? It's October, right? You know, here we are, and the 20th trans person, I should say, has been murdered, right, just the other day. And they're all transgender women.
You mean this year?
This year, right. So we're not even done with the year, and 20 people already have been murdered because they're trans. It's almost all women of color and all women, right? So... Mm. So first, between transgender men and transgender women, there's a thing, right, that, you know, and I'm trying to figure out ways to talk about this, because if you look at media right now, you'd think that transgender issues are transgender women's issues, and transgender men are getting we're totally invisible. And part of that is because when we transition, oftentimes we are able to blend really seamlessly, and so we do become invisible. We're not visibly trans, whereas for many trans women, that's not the case. It's much harder to blend and to just sort of, you know, not be noticed and have that privacy, right? And that visibility leads you to a vulnerability, right? It's why transgender women report being stopped by the police walking while trans, you know, picked up as sex workers, you know, assumed to be sex workers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then you add the element of race, right? And you know, it's a further visibility, a further marginalization to a group that's already been marginalized. And so we have to do a lot more work in our communities to really be allies to one another and advocates and you know, good brothers and sisters, honestly, you know?
We're going to get back to talking more about violence against this community in our final quarter, but we have to take a break for Station ID. This is the North Avenue Lounge. Stick around.
The music is different here. The vibrations are different. Not like planet Earth. Another place in the universe, up under different stars. That would be where the ultradestin would come in. Equation-wise, the first thing to do is to consider time as officially ended.
Tune in Saturdays at 8 p.m. for Coffee and Sushi, playing the best in atmospheric, chill-out electronic music. Saturdays at 8 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
This is the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Shannon M. Turner. Today we're talking with Scott Turner Schofield and Carla Moseley, currently starring on The Bold and the Beautiful. When we took our break, we were really getting into some interesting territory, talking about violence but mostly against the trans community. I wanted to talk about storylines in pop culture, because one thing that I think is interesting is the way we seem to have a little bit more of a normalizing effect in pop culture. First of all, is this the first storyline in a soap opera that's about a trans character?
No.
Okay.
I don't know all of the dates, and I hate to get it wrong, but we know we had All My Children mm-hmm. had a transgender character for a while. But was Coronation Street the first, Carla?
I think so. At least that's what our British friends always say.
Yeah, they're all like, we did
the
it.
First.
Yeah. You're so far behind America. Yeah.
Okay.
But so, there, and a few others. Mm-hmm. So, no, we're not the first. But like Carla said, Maya is currently the only transgender character and as a series regular on television. So.
But there's a lot sort of bubbling up in the ethos, right, between Orange is the New Black and the fabulous Laverne Cox, Transparent, just a lot of really good stuff going on in terms of, like I said, normalizing, whereas before it seemed like a lot of the stories were a lot about violence, like Boys Don't Cry and Silence of the Lambs, like really...
Violence or Freaks.
Yeah. What's the one... Crying Game.
Right.
Yeah. But we're still encountering this backlash. Or would you call it a backlash? Do you think that because we're talking about it more in the broad culture, that that's where the violence is coming from?
I mean...
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Carla.
No, I was just saying, I wonder, I don't think that it's new. I think it's like... similar to the police brutality, where it's like, we've been saying for years that this is happening, and, you know, now...
we can see it better.
...being documented, mm-hmm. and I think social media is helping to do that. And I actually think that the sort of groundswell of awareness that's beginning to happen in the trans community is then being reflected, because now it's newsworthy, mm-hmm. Because this is something that we're finally just starting to talk about. That would be my guess. You have a different thought?
I completely agree. Yeah. You know, now BuzzFeed picks it up when a trans, you know, every time a transgender woman is murdered, it's on BuzzFeed, it's out there, it's you know, it's going places people are, and people know what it means mm-hmm. also. Mm. You know, I've been doing this work since 2002. And I've personally taught thousands of people around the country what transgender was, right? And now Caitlyn Jenner, I mean, say what you want about that show and say what you want about her and her motives, but there's nobody in this country that doesn't know what transgender is, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's through her or through the efforts of all, you know, our show, every, you know. So, now we're in this awareness space and we have to deal with it, right? And all of this stuff, like, you know, they say in like, you know, in spirituality, right? Like, it only comes up to be healed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so now it's up. You know, and we do have a lot of healing to do. Mm-hmm. And it's a process. And this is the thing that I'm not popular about, you know, for my thoughts on this. But, you know, yes, I recognize we have so far to go. And I actually do hold radical views on what we need to do to get there. And I understand myself as a person in process that I cannot grow and change any faster than I am. And the same holds true for society, right? And the thing that I'm so pleased about, you know, I mean, Bold and the Beautiful, come on. Like, people watching daytime television, right? Like, who are so vocal and who I mean, Carla, I don't know what you get, but all I get, with the exception of, like, you know, those couple people that we texted about, right? Who are horrible.
Right. Like, exactly.
Right. Like two people, right? But like, everybody is positive about this and they care and they want to grow and be welcoming and you know, they want the world to change and they want to help it, right? So
yeah, absolutely. You know, and from a demographic that I think on paper you would have believed would be up in arms about the storyline. You know, it just hasn't been the case. You know, people of all ages, of all races, of, you know, all along the gender spectrum, it's a really beautiful thing. And I think that's important, you know, because I think that money talks. Like, we're in an industry, we're in a business, right? So, like, in addition to, it would be great if we all made our decisions based on, like, wanting to do the best thing. But the truth is that the business people don't. They make their choices based on money. And what we can say and what we've seen now is that when we include more diversity in our storytelling, whether it's about gender identity, sexual identity, race, you know, age, whatever it is, it actually increases the viewership, as long as it's done well and as long as it's a story that we can all relate to.
Yeah, I think you actually said you felt like it was a pretty savvy business decision that they made.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, like, it's good for business people to know that, yeah, you can take risks in this way, that it actually isn't a risk, that it actually is, it's a solid business decision, and it will bring in new viewers. It certainly has energized the viewership of our show. Our ratings are up. And we have all kinds of people, you know, that I hear from on social media all the time. We say, oh, I just started watching the show because of the storyline.
And I think this is really a challenge to you, Scott, as your writer self. I think the other side is to make sure those storylines stay authentic and not, you know, and I have no idea. I have to confess to the audience, I don't actually watch The Bold and the Beautiful. I really applaud what's happening here.
But, I'll bring you some DVDs.
Thank you. But I think in order to make sure that the storylines that are happening don't play in the realm of the stereotype, that it's having the writers who live that life in the room to make sure that they, you know, that it's a lived, authentic experience that's being represented.
Totally. And, you know, that's what's happening on Transparent, is that they've got people at all levels, you know, behind the camera and on camera who are there to make sure that this is happening, you know. And at the same time, you know, this is my take on what's happening in popular culture with transgender stories right now. If you look at the Elle Fanning movie, if you look at The Danish Girl, even Transparent, honestly, you're looking at stories that are about cis people dealing with the transgender people in their lives. The transgender story is a central theme, but it is not the central story. You know, my dream is, you know, to make debutante balls into a movie where you're with a transgender person and seeing the world through that lens. What would that do to your understanding of a transgender story if you got to go through it with that person?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that's the next step, right? Where we are right now is, yeah, in society, cis people are going, what the heck with this trans thing? What is this? And I have to deal with it, and my life gets transformed because you have come out and transformed the world. Like, that's the thing about trans stories, right? Like, they transform things, right? So, right? So that's what we're dealing with right now, and I think it's going to take some more time, and I hope that Hollywood holds true to the diversity mandate that it's been doing so well in every other aspect. We've got people with disabilities, we've got people of color of all kinds of ethnicities and backgrounds coming on. You know, it's not enough yet, but it's getting there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they continue that trans isn't just the flavor of the last couple years and then we're done with it, you know, but that eventually you're going to have a sitcom about a trans guy, right? Because it's going to be about life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that that's what needs to happen with everything. I mean, that the journey is about no longer having the othering of, you know, the classic black best friend who, like, reflects everything back to you or anything.
Right.
You know, it's that it's the central story, as you said, the hero,
mm-hmm.
not the, you know, from the white, straight, often male perspective, you know, encountering everything as other.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it does go back to exactly what we've been saying, which is that we need diversity not just in our characters and in our actors, but also in the writer's room, mm-hmm. in the people who are behind the camera and the people who are funding these projects.
Absolutely.
And I really see it happening. I got to go to a diversity party for the Emmys, and just to meet all of these different people who are, you know, inside the machine, you know, and who are really making it go. I left there with a lot of hope.
Fantastic. Are there any legislative pieces that folks should be paying attention to or supports that are coming down the pike?
So a lot of things are happening. The thing that people need to pay attention to right now, and especially during the election, because, you know, marriage equality is no longer a political football, so we're going after the next scapegoats, which are immigrants and trans people, right? And both.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bathroom bills that are happening, they have bills in Texas and Florida, and I think like 17 states are currently staring down these bathroom bills that would require businesses to police their bathrooms. Because otherwise, anyone who finds someone who, quote unquote, should not be in that bathroom can civilly sue the business owner. And so small business owners are under threat, whatever, all because we want to make an other. And, you know, the instances of people, and what they do is they say, like, you know, there are men in dresses. Men will dress up as women in order to get into bathrooms with these liberal laws, and they will then assault women and girls, right? And so that plays on, like, a huge fear, right, about, like, sexual assault, right, which is a real thing, and we actually need to be talking about sexual assault as it is, right? But they're playing on it from this totally absurd direction. The instances of that particular thing happening, like, we have statistics about it. It's like less than 1% of people who assault women, men who assault women in bathrooms, are dressed as a woman. Like, that's not even a thing, right? But it's simply just like, how can we continue to other people? Because othering people is what wins us points in elections. So just don't believe it. You know, there's a terrible ad that's going around about a man in a dress chasing a little girl into a bathroom, and, you know, it's fear-mongering. It's just trying to make you afraid. Transgender people, we have to work so hard to have dignity in our lives, to have even privacy in our lives. So if you see a transgender person in the bathroom, all they want to do is pee. Like, just let them pee in peace, right? Maybe say, like, hey, nice shoes, right? Like, those are the things that you should say to a transgender person in a bathroom. Like, you know, not should you be in here. You know, we're trying to live authentically. We're trying to have privacy and dignity, and having there be tension around the bathroom that we're using strips us of all of that. And it's the work of allyship to not do that.
I want to thank our guests today. I feel like we could have talked to either of you for 2 hours each, but it was really amazing to have you both on at the same time and talk about who you are and what you're doing in the world, which I really appreciate you both for the work that you're doing. You can find the show after the fact on NorthAvenueLounge.com as well as the WREK website. You can also find Scott and Carla on their websites and on social media. I'm Shannon M. Turner. This is the North Avenue Lounge. Have a great day.